This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Sunday, the most powerful earthquake in 40 years shook the ground deep beneath the Indian Ocean near the northwestern tip of the Indonesian island of Sumatra. The 9.0 magnitude quake sent massive waves across the Indian Ocean at more than 500 miles an hour when they struck land in Indonesia and Thailand, in India and Sri Lanka, and on the coast of Africa. Walls of water tore through seaside villages and towns. There was no warning, so the disaster caught people totally unawares. So far, more than 20,000 are reported dead. Many thousands more are missing. Millions are homeless. And there's now worry about food, shelter, disease, and about possible aftershocks. Later in the program, Viktor Yushchenko survives dioxin poisoning and fraud to claim victory in Ukraine's presidential election. But first, the Indian Ocean tsunamis. If you have questions about what happened, what happens next, or what you can do to help, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Paul Watson, South Asia Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. He's with us by phone from Madras in India. And good evening. Nice of you to be with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
What's the scene like there in Madras?
Things are being cleared up pretty quickly here in the city, but I was some hours, maybe 3 to 4 hours drive south of the city today in some of the fishing villages that were hardest hit, and things are going much more slowly there. They're still waiting for food relief. The bodies are being collected, but they're being buried in mass graves, effectively, of about 50 to 60 bodies per pit in one town that we were in, because health officials are worried that if they lie around too long, that disease will spread.
Mm. How are the people coping in these villages?
Well, the odd thing about the destruction in this catastrophe, if you've seen images of earthquakes, for instance, you expect widespread destruction. In this case, there's a band of destruction running about half a mile for hundreds of miles along the coast. So if you were in that first half mile where the main force of the waves struck, then you've suffered a lot. But go just past that half mile and life is relatively normal.
What are people talking about today?
We saw large groups of people who were just stunned. In this one village where the first few rows of houses were just obliterated as if a huge sledgehammer had come down on them. The few people who had come back into the village to retrieve their belongings were talking about this wave, and it was a series of three, they said, which to them were actually like living beings. One described it almost as if it were a beast that had come out of the sea with this evil intent to attack them. And one man, you know, these are fishermen who've lived off the sea for generations, and they know what can happen. One said, you know, we are all just tired of this. We only live now to take care of our families.
Obviously, people in an area like that are accustomed to typhoons, monsoons, the rains that arrive at regular, all kinds of storms. This is unique.
It is. And, you know, one police officer held his hand up with an open palm, and he said it was literally like a wall standing, moving through, as opposed to a normal wave that you would expect to roll. And he said he'd never heard of anything like it or seen anything like it in his life.
Hmm. Is there a sign of government aid workers or outside aid workers arriving in these villages you're thinking about, you're talking about south of Madras?
There are. It's spotty in areas because it takes a couple of days for them to mobilize. But, for instance, in this one abandoned village, there were dozens of police who were guarding to make sure that there was no looting and that sort of thing. But people were complaining that they didn't have food, and things are going too slowly for them.
As you mentioned, there is enormous concern, first of all, sanitation, the grisly business of disposing of so many bodies. Fresh water is going to be another problem.
That's correct. And there are still large stagnant ponds, even small lakes in some cases, of the seawater that has just been trapped in these villages, and there are rotting fish and livestock in these things. So it's going to take a long time to clean it up properly.
Mm-hmm. Now, as these people look to the future, I guess they're looking to the immediate future, the next couple of days, and surviving. As you say, food is going to be a problem, but is there concern about aftershocks, about more of these waves arriving?
There are indeed, and there was one off the Indian coast today of about six, magnitude of six on the Richter scale. And the other complicating factor here is the weather. There's a pretty steady rain today, and I understand it's supposed to continue tomorrow. So people are both spooked and wondering where they should turn to get aid to rebuild their houses, for instance.
It was hours after the earthquake in on the other side of the Indian Ocean when these waves arrived where you are south of in Madras and this village that you're describing south of Madras. Obviously, there was no warning.
That's right. We spoke to a Catholic Church priest in Madras who said that he looked at his watch in the morning when he felt the first tremors of the earthquake, and it was roughly 2 hours later that he heard this loud noise and sent one of his people out to look, and he came running back and said there's a 15-foot wave coming. So that's 2 hours that people could have been warned and instructed to move away from the coast. And again, they only had to move half a mile. This wouldn't have been a mass movement of people, just half a mile, and most people would have been fine.
And one final question. Does it look from where you are that the government emergency services are going to be up for the massive cleanup and rebuilding effort that's I guess, getting underway today?
From what I saw today, it is organized. They're uniformed police officers and such, keeping order, and there is no mass chaos. They're just dazed people who need help. They need money and food, to put it bluntly.
Paul Watson, thank you very much. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Paul Watson, South Asia Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, joined us by phone from Madras in India. If you have questions about the tsunamis, what caused them, what effects they've had, and what could be happening over the next few days, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Tom Casadevall, the Regional Director for the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver, Colorado. He joins us by phone from his office there, and it's good of you to speak with you again.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon. Tell us what caused the tsunami.
Well, the tsunami was produced by a large earthquake that occurred just off the coast of the island of Sumatra in Indonesia in the Indian Ocean. And that was basically the event that generated the tsunami.
I've read that it was so big, the whole island of Sumatra moved about 100 feet to the southwest.
Well, you may have more recent information than I have. I hadn't seen that particular story. The type of event that caused this particular tsunami was not the normal type of earthquake that we expect in this region of the world. And so you may have additional information that I haven't seen yet, Neil.
Well, that was in the Los Angeles Times, so it may be outdated information for all I know, but that's what I did see. But as you say, this is very unusual activity for this part of the world.
Yeah, it is. A little bit about the geologic setting for that part of the world. This is the boundary between two tectonic plates. If you think of the surface of the Earth as being broken up into a dozen or more large geologic land masses that move relative to one another, oftentimes these move by slipping by each other. In some cases, one plate can move by diving under an adjacent plate. In some cases, that plate may move by moving over an adjacent plate. And the last type of activity we call, it produces what we call a thrust fault, the thrusting of one landmass over another. Now, in this case, those landmasses are at the bottom of the ocean in several thousand feet of water depth. But when that happens in an earthquake this large, the amount of offset or the amount of geologic displacement that occurs can be very large. Now, because this fault is probably exposed on the sea floor off of Sumatra. We don't really know how much displacement that there was, but certainly it was probably on the order of meters to perhaps tens of meters. When that thrusting occurs, it will lift the overlying water mass, and that's essentially what the triggering mechanism was that produced the tidal wave that occurred yesterday.
And obviously water does not compress, which is a great deal of the problem, and that violent activity then sends a wave out radially from the center of the event?
That's correct. Essentially, that's right.
And how big can these things be?
Well, the event that occurred here in the United States late Christmas Day evening or the day after Christmas early in the morning, local time in Sumatra, was one of the largest earthquakes that we've recorded in the last 100 years. The preliminary estimates of the magnitude of this event put it at a magnitude 9. I'm sure that in coming days or weeks, as seismologists refine their understanding of the mechanism for this particular earthquake, that magnitude may be fine-tuned, but that notwithstanding, this was one of the largest earthquakes we've had in the last 100 years. So that goes by way of saying we don't have a lot of experience with tsunamis generated from this type of earthquake in this part of the world. If we look at two other major events, the Good Friday earthquake in 1964 in Alaska, and then the May 1960 earthquake off the coast of Chile in South America, we have a pretty good sense of how both of those earthquakes generated tidal waves or tsunamis that moved across the Pacific. We don't have a lot of experience with large earthquakes on the western side of the Pacific or in the Indian Ocean, and certainly we don't have much experience with tidal waves generated by earthquakes in that region.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a listener on the line. Again, our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, and Andrea is with us from Providence, Rhode Island.
Yes, I was wondering if you could give a comparison between this and the earthquake and tsunami from Krakatoa.
Great. The earthquake and tsunami from Krakatoa. Krakatoa is a volcanic island that is located on the west edge of the island of Java and just east of the island of Sumatra in the Sumatra Strait. So geographically, that's where it's located. Back in August of 1883, there was a very large volcanic eruption of that island that basically destroyed the island. It related in collapse of an island, a very large submarine landslide, and that submarine landslide was the event that produced the tsunami that washed over the western shores of the island of Java and the southern and eastern shores of the island of Sumatra. There were more than 36,000 fatalities from that particular eruption. Unlike the earthquake that occurred on Christmas Day, or the day after Christmas, Sumatra time, that was produced by a tectonic event. It had nothing to do, as far as we know, with any kind of volcanic activity. So that's the basic difference. It was a difference in the mechanism that produced the tidal wave.
Andrea, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And we're Tom Casadevall, hang with us, all right?
Yes.
We're going to
sure.
take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take more of your calls. Again, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address, totn@npr.org. Do you have questions about the cause of the destruction or the emergency efforts underway? Also, as mentioned, you can send us email, totn@npr.org. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the massive tsunamis in the Indian Ocean this weekend and the earthquake which caused them. With us is Tom Casadevall, Regional Director for U.S. Geological Survey in Denver, Colorado. Of course, you're invited to join the conversation. If you have questions about the science behind the disaster or relief efforts underway, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Let's get another listener on the line, and William is with us in Moorhead, Minnesota.
Hi, my question was about about the warning, if there was any of the earthquake. Was it detected by a seismologist? For example, I've heard that laboratories in Los Angeles could detect it. So I guess my question is if that was true, and if so, what was done to evacuate people, and what were the nature of the efforts to get people out and to get people inland, and how successful were those efforts?
Mm-hmm. Tom, what can you tell us about that?
Yes, thank you, William. First of all, to the best of our knowledge, this earthquake, the magnitude 9 event that occurred U.S. time late Christmas Day, was not predicted or was not forecast. And once again, there may be information out there that I'm not familiar with. Let me say that in this part of the world, we don't have a lot of seismic instrumentation, for example, on the island of Sumatra. And then if you look on a map of the world, the Indian Ocean extends to the west from there. There aren't very many islands in the Indian Ocean that have seismic instrumentation. So, first of all, to the best of my knowledge, this event was not forecasted or predicted in any way. Having said that, this is a very active area, seismically speaking. In other words, on any given day, if you go to the National Earthquake Information Center website, you will see that there are earthquakes occurring along this part of the Sumatran fault system. They generally tend to be fairly small, but they do occur fairly frequently. But once again, very small magnitude. So first of all, this event itself, to the best of my knowledge, was not predicted or forecast. However, once the event occurred, it is possible. And there was knowledge that a tidal wave or a tsunami was in the process of being generated. And that information was available, but the problem we ran into was that there were not appropriate agencies in places like India and in Somalia on the east in the Horn of Africa region.
You didn't know who to call.
There was no system set up by which we could take that information and translate it into actions that the public could react to.
So the earthquake, not predictable, but once the earthquake happened, the tsunamis were predictable, but you didn't know who to get in touch with.
That's correct.
William, thank you very much for the call.
Yes, thank you.
Joining us now is Alfred Ironside, a UNICEF spokesman. He's at their headquarters in New York to describe some of the relief efforts underway. Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Ironside.
My pleasure, Neil. Hi.
How many aid organizations are working there now, and who's coordinating who does what?
Well, there's a whole bunch of international aid organizations who are getting involved. UNICEF, the Red Cross, other UN agencies, Oxfam, Save the Children, basically any of the big international agencies you've heard of are all either on the ground already or are sending people in quickly. So there's a lot of relief activity underway.
The United States has prepared a $15 million aid package, at least to start. It includes $100,000 to each of the four hardest-hit countries and $4 million to the International Red Cross. Obviously, other nations are going to be supplying money, but this is going to be a massive effort.
It's going to be a massive effort, and we're talking about certainly millions of people who live in the affected areas. I was just talking to someone in our Sri Lanka office who said that half of all the districts in Sri Lanka were affected by this tsunami, which sort of wrapped around the island, so it just didn't affect the side that faces Indonesia. And so it's a very serious challenge all across Sri Lanka, all across the eastern coast of India, and of course, north of Indonesia and Thailand and other countries.
Obviously, because of UNICEF and the Red Cross and the Red Crescent have people on the ground already, they're in the best condition to deliver aid, I suspect.
Well, that's right. And actually, all of us work very closely together in these situations. In each country where there's a major international relief effort, we're all sitting down at the table essentially today and tomorrow to decide who's doing what. And that's done in conjunction with the local government so that there is not overlap. And this is quite ordinary in these situations to sit down and decide, okay, who's going to take the lead on delivering water? Who's going to take the lead on ensuring there's medical supplies? And everyone can contribute to that, all the agencies, but one agency will take the lead to coordinate and make sure there's not a lot of overlap.
And, of course, these arrangements might vary from place to place.
Most definitely. They will vary from country to country, depending on which agencies are strongest in which areas in each country.
Obviously, it also depends on the cooperation with the local government. You would think they would be eager, though in some places, maybe not.
Well, it definitely does vary. I mean, Sri Lanka immediately said, we welcome help. In fact, we require help. And fortunately, UNICEF has a very large active office in Sri Lanka. So that's where we've had the most immediate relief effort already underway. India, of course, very, very large country, a very powerful government, and lots of resources within the country to provide relief. We have been asked in some of the southernmost states to add to their efforts, and we're rushing supplies and other other kinds of relief into southern India. Indonesia, it's a bit different situation. As you know, the state of Aceh in the north of the island of Sumatra is the most heavily affected, but it's also affected by a civil conflict, which has placed this state under essentially military rule. And so it's a bit more complicated for international relief agencies to work in that area. We're still talking with the Indonesian government about how that can happen.
Mm-hmm. And obviously other governments in various other places. And we're not going to understand the scale of this. I'm sure that there are disasters as yet undiscovered.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, it's really on the scale of it 2 days later is really just becoming clear to all of us. Again, the office in Sri Lanka said right now the UNICEF staff are focused on helping clear dead bodies away from these villages and communities so that the relief effort can begin in earnest. And so there's a lot of things that have to be done before you can really sit down and say, let's take care of ensuring safe water for these people, let's start rebuilding.
And dealing with the dead bodies is not simply a matter of reverence and respect for the dead. It's a matter of the health of the living.
It is, although it's less of a challenge than myth might make us think. You're quite right. We have to be very respectful of the dead. But at the same time, in areas where we can't clear the bodies as quickly as we might like, they don't pose a particular health risk themselves. However, if they're contaminating water supplies, that's where we'll see the problem.
Hmm.
So we're really more concerned in terms of public health about the cleanliness of water supplies.
Here's an email question from Ivy West in Washington, D.C. What may I be able to donate toward the persons across Southern Asia who lost their lives, their families, and their property as a result of the earthquake?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I'd love to be able to say, do a clothing drive in your community, and we can use that. But the truth is most relief organizations, especially the big international ones, really require contributions of money. And there's a number of reasons for this, chief among which is it's a lot more efficient. When we have to transport donated clothing items from all the way on the other side of the planet, it's very expensive. And so that adds a tremendous amount of cost to a relief operation. The other reason is that when we have money to spend in the countries that are affected, we're helping to rejuvenate the local economies. So contributions of money are really the primary way that Americans can help support relief efforts in that region. There may be some localized food drives and clothing drives where, let's say, a local church has arranged for transportation of the items itself. But, again, that can be costly.
What if somebody has time but not money?
Well, if they'd like to volunteer, that's also an area where it's not quite as easy as we might like. We often suggest that folks take an opportunity like this to volunteer with the Red Cross, volunteer for Doctors Without Borders, and other volunteer-based organizations so that they can be trained and ready for the next time they are needed. The truth is, when you get out into these very, very rough circumstances in far-off countries, it really requires people who've been trained, who've been there, who've experienced this kind of disaster before. And so while we welcome volunteers, it really means that you have to commit yourself to over time being trained up to be a disaster relief volunteer.
Alfred Einside, stay with us in case we get questions on relief questions, but we also want to get some listeners back in on the conversation. Still with us also is Tom Casadevall of the U.S. Geological Survey, who's obviously been watching all of this and spent time himself in Indonesia. Let's get some listeners on the line. This is Warren from Mustang, Oklahoma.
Yes, I had a question for the seismologist. I was curious to know, or I think I heard on NPR yesterday that the tidal waves travel at something like 600 miles an hour, and I was curious to know if ships at sea or sailboats or whatever were in peril.
The velocities that you quote are certainly within the ones that I've heard about. In terms of ships at sea or other conveyances at sea, because the amplitudes of these waves are so large, it would probably feel, if you were in a sailboat, for example, in the Indian Ocean during the event yesterday, you probably would have felt, if you felt anything, maybe even just a gentle uplifting and then lowering down. So because the amplitudes of these waves are so long, they don't appear as a noticeable front or wave breaking on a shore like we might experience on the east coast or west coast of the United States. It's really when those waves begin to shallow as they run up on the along a coastline that the wave aspect of the tidal wave really shows itself. So if you're at sea on a tanker or in a sailboat, it's probably going to be just a slight undulation that you might feel.
When you say amplitude, do you just mean the size of the wave?
The length of the wave compared to its height. And so while the height may be several hundred feet, the amplitude will be on the order of miles. So the actual wave itself, when you're in the open ocean, won't feel like very much.
And when,
if anything.
And when we heard from Paul Watson of the Los Angeles Times, villagers describing three separate waves, were these different shocks or one event?
Well, it was probably related to one event. But once again, if your beach is exactly perpendicular to the direction that the wave is moving, you'll probably only have one wave that comes ashore. But let's suppose we have a bay, an enclosure, and as that wave approaches the bay, it will begin to refract and bounce off of the enclosing bay itself. So when oftentimes in these cases where you get reports of multiple waves coming ashore, it's because there's been refraction of the wave in an enclosure, or you get amplification of the wave, for example, around a lighthouse or a point of land.
And would this wave, we're calling it a wave, in mind's eye, people see, you know, a 30-foot high wall of water crashing onto the beach, or is it like a storm surge, just water that rises and rises and rises?
Well, it's in some cases, once again, it depends how quickly that wave makes itself ashore. And if the shallowing occurs quite suddenly or quite abruptly, there will, in fact, be a wave like you would see a wave on the north coast of Hawaii during a storm season, or on the east coast of the United States if you go down to Ocean City, Maryland, although those are much smaller waves compared to what we experienced the last 2 days in the Indian Ocean.
We're talking about the Indian Ocean tsunamis over the weekend. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Jerry. Jerry's calling from Newark.
Hi. I had a question similar to the previous callers on the effect on commercial shipping and fishing fleets, and I got an answer to that by listening. And that's kind of surprising based on the violence of the event. But I had one other comment then. There is an early warning system. I heard on a report before your show came on.
Right.
There was an early warning system that could have alerted these countries, particularly India. And there was one other country that the speakers were talking about. But India and this other country don't happen to be signatories to that treaty. So here you have a case where, for some reason or another, people don't bother to participate in this treaty, and I was led to believe by that program that it had to do with the frequency of the events. These things only happen once in every few hundred years, so people figure, why bother? But they said on that show that in this particular case, there are people who are signatories to this, and those people would have been warned, would have had enough time to be warned, but it's just for some political or diplomatic reason, two of the largest countries in the area don't happen to be signatories to that treaty.
Well, Jerry, why don't we attack both of your problems? First, Albert Ironside at UNICEF. Obviously, a big ship in the middle of the ocean, or even a small ship in the middle of the ocean, not likely to be bothered. Most fishing ships, fishing boats, are quite near the shore, and many of them were destroyed in this tsunami. Any idea of the economic impact?
Well, first of all, Neil, I know you keep wanting to call me Albert Einstein, but
Alfred, I apologize.
It's okay. Yeah, I mean, fishing is obviously a major industry in all these coastal areas, and while we don't yet have an estimate of the damage to that industry as a whole, we know at the very local level that these families who live along the coast have essentially lost their livelihood. Their boats have been destroyed, their fishing docks, their equipment. And so that has real consequences for what kind of a relief effort will be needed. There will be a sustained effort required to help these people get back on their feet and to rebuild that fishing economy.
And let's get to Jerry's other point, and that on this warning system to Tom Cassidy-Duvall.
Yeah, your point's well taken, Jerry. But let's keep in mind that it's one thing for the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Hawaii to make appropriate phone calls or to send appropriate messages to, for example, the weather service in Thailand or the weather service in India. It's a very different issue for that weather service in India or Thailand, or in Sri Lanka in this case, to then communicate that information in a time-effective way to the people whose communities might be impacted by this. And finally, even if the local communities had been able to be notified, because these events are so infrequent and because it's unlikely that anyone with a living memory could recall what happened the last time a tsunami affected their shore, knowing how local people might react without training them or without informing them of what procedures to take, for example, simply go to higher land, that type of message is not practiced in many areas around the Indian Ocean simply because tsunamis are very rare events there.
We have heard reports that both Japan and Australia said today that they would be willing to begin to construct such a system similar to the one that they have in the Pacific for the nations of the Indian Ocean. Obviously, stay tuned to NPR News today for more on that and much more as the details of this tragedy become clearer from the Indian Ocean. Alfred Ironside, thank you very much for being with us today.
Pleasure, Neil. Thanks.
Alfred Ironside is a UNICEF spokesperson. He joined us from their headquarters in New York. And we'd also like to thank Tom Cassidy-Duvall, Regional Director for the U.S. Geological Survey. Appreciate your time today, sir.
You're very welcome, Neil.
More after the break. We're going to be focusing on the presidential elections in Ukraine. It's Talk of the Nation, NPR News.